This podcast edition of Section D was first aired on the 29th of November 2011 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Section D, Monocle's weekly design show with me, Hugo MacDonald. Coming up on today's programme, we've a wonderfully mixed bag of stories. Kicking things off, we headed to my favourite biannual furniture market, the mid-century modern furniture sale in South London.
Some people say, you know, in times of recession, people like to buy more homely things that have a bit more soul and craft about them. But I just think they're good objects, you know, and they're very friendly objects.
That was our reporter, Thea Urdal, checking in on the burgeoning market in the UK for second-hand mid-century design. We also sat down with British architect David Adjaye to hear about his experiences of architecture in Africa.
Getting to go to 52 countries and realising how little I knew as a person from the continent was astonishing.
And we travelled to Vienna to hear how the city is using its design heritage wisely to promote its tradition and inspire a future generation of Austrian designers.
We bring together young designers with these companies. Sometimes they're also simple shops, but usually they produce something or they have a craft. And we ask both of them to get to know each other, to kind of exchange, share their knowledge and their expertise.
All that, plus a perfect Japanese solution for emergency housing in disaster zones, a report on the Aga Khan Award for Architecture, Monocle's photo director, Poppy Shibamoto's feelings towards wooden birds, and a trolley dash around our favourite design shops across the globe. That's all to come on this week's Section D, here on Monocle 24. Stay tuned. Before we get things started, it's time to hear what's been happening in the world of design across the globe. And that means one thing. It's this week's design news with Gillian DeBias.
Finnish design star Harri Koskinen has been appointed design director of the historic Finnish glass and tableware company Itala. No stranger to the company, Koskinen has previously designed numerous projects for Itala. Under his new appointment, Koskinen will enhance the role of design in the brand, acting as a consultant while still continuing as an independent designer. The French Ministry of Culture presented its Maître d'Art Awards in Paris last week to six master artisans. Winners included couture embroiderer Françoise Lesage, ceramicist Gérard Borde, and Baccarat crystal engraver Yves Paris. Like the Japanese National Living Treasure accolade, the title is presented to those who've shown an outstanding contribution to their creative field. A prototype alpine pod has been anchored to the side of Mont Blanc as a rest stop for climbers. The living ecological alpine pod has been designed by Luca Genticor and Stefano Testa. The hut, which accommodates up to 12 people, is designed to resist avalanches and landslides and provide spectacular views over the Alps. A new concept store, Emporium, has been opened in Baku, aimed at broadening Azerbaijani's retail experience in the luxury sector. Emporium was designed by Yukio Ishiyama of Milan's architecture practice Garde. Visitors can buy an eclectic mix of names from Azadine Alaya and Loren Scott to younger designers like Mary Katransu, alongside music, books and design objects all spread over three floors. And finally, on Monday, the Savoy played host to the British Fashion Awards. Celebrating the best of established and emerging talent, the event showed British fashion in robust health. Designer of the Year went to Sarah Burton for her creative direction at Alexander McQueen. The Red Carpet Award went to Stella McCartney and the New Establishment Award to Christopher Kane. Kim Jones was awarded Menswear Designer. Mary Katransu won Emerging Talent Womenswear and Christopher Rayburn Emerging Talent Menswear. And on the business side, Victoria Beckham was the recipient of the Designer Brand Award. And the British Fashion Award for Outstanding Achievement went to the inspirational Paul Smith, a true British icon in the world of fashion.
Thank you very much, Gillian. You're listening to Section D here on Monocle 24. Now, in an annual calendar that's ever more stuffed with design fairs, showcasing new furniture week after week, same stories in different cities, there's a growing debate in the industry about whether the world really needs another new chair. My favourite design event happens close to home. in Dulwich College in South London, to be precise, and there's nothing new on show at all. The Mid-Century Modern Show gathers together second-hand furniture dealers from around Britain for 2 days in the school's communal spaces. They show their hoard of mainly Scandinavian mid-century furniture to a hungry crowd of design enthusiasts and homeowners. It's a very stable market, and buying vintage is one that's on the rise. We dispatched our reporter, Thea Urdal, to trawl the terraces and find out why mid-century is most popular.
Twice a year, design lovers flock to a lovely Victorian boarding school in South London to attend the Mid-Century Design Fair at Dulwich College. Now in its 10th year, the fair is recognised as the mother of all destinations for 20th century design classics and modern collectibles. The autumn edition just took place last weekend, and Monocle donned woolen scarves and ventured into the foggy weather to find the reason why mid-century design seemingly never goes out of style. Lucy Ryder Richardson, who initiated the fair with Petra Curtis in 2002, talks us through the history of the event.
Well, we started as with a little photocopy. Petra had drawn a chair on it, and amazingly enough, we got 500 people the first show, which we were quite shocked about. And then at that stage, we only had about 20 designers and 30 dealers, I think. Might have even been a bit less than that. And now we have 3,000 people coming in 6 hours, and we have 95 dealers and designers twice a year at Dulwich College, and we also have a mid-century show now twice a year at Lord's Cricket Ground, which we're really, really excited about.
Mid-century design will for many always be synonymous with the likes of Arne Jacobsen and Hans Jørvegner. Sarah Potter of the eponymous design firm Sarah Potter elaborates on the everlasting Danish appeal.
I still think in terms of affordability and what is appropriate at the moment, in terms of the cleverness of Danish design, we're living in ever-decreasing spaces and the lines are very sharp. Very often the furniture is very adaptive. You can get a table which will go from a coffee table into a dining table into a console table, and I think it's very flexible, and again based on price it'll be hard to beat at the moment, especially given that second-hand or pre-loved furniture is affordable compared to what it would cost to make today. Right, we're standing right in front of one. This is a dining table designed by Frem Rolle for Hans Olsen. It is made of teak. It expands. If you pull those two ends, it has an integral leaf which folds out to make a four-seater into a six-seater. And the chairs, as you can see, tuck in completely under the apron so that you just have the profile, the circular profile, a very minimal design, and they sell like hotcakes.
Mid-century modern has a cult following, but apart from eyeing the Eames rocker, what items should we be buying at the moment?
My name's Saxon Durrant, I'm the owner of Metro Retro. Always popular are industrial artifacts, things from old factories, stools, benches, lockers, workbenches, anything that's old and characterful people are starting to buy. Things that look a bit more beaten up nowadays, where they used to want things absolutely spit and polished, looking totally perfect. Now they're not quite so worried. They want to see the character and the age in things a bit more now. Some people say, you know, in times of recession, people like to buy more homely things that have a bit more soul and craft about them. But I just think they're good objects, you know, and they're very friendly objects. A lot of the metal stuff, people think it's very hard to live with it, but it's actually quite easy because it's... although it's been in an industrial space, it's still warm and friendly, and you know it's seen a hard life, and that's what people like. And you can't fake that. People are always looking for good storage. That's what really sells. Things that solve a problem, and if you can solve that problem using something that's vintage and got a bit of character to it, rather than something that's worthless as soon as it's taken out the shop door, then that's all for the good.
I'm Karen Lansdowne, and I have Travel on Paper, which is original vintage posters from the 50s and 60s. I find at the moment that airline posters are very popular, especially TWA. And the other things that I sell a lot of are Olympic posters. And the most popular Olympic posters are 1972 Munich Olympics because of the designer Ottel Eicher, who was a fantastic designer. The iconography was amazing. But those are the two areas that probably I'm specialising in at the moment.
I'm Jonathan Stevenson, owner of Rocket Gallery. In the area of this mid-century Dutch design, three things that people should buy would be a chair by Friso Kramer. He did the very famous Result chair and the Reform chair. Both of those are absolute Dutch classics. I would then recommend really any piece by Martin Visser, who was again a very interesting designer of that period. He actually ended his life as head of the Rotterdam Art Museum. So again, very interesting. He spent like 30 years working as a designer running a company called Spectrum, and then spent a couple of decades running an art museum, which is a great crossover. He did chairs, tables, sideboards, so I find it hard to pick one item by him. And then really, probably Wim Rietveld, who was the son of Rietveld the architect, and he died in the 80s, but again, he was part of the Total Group. He did some wonderful pieces, but there's one particular piece he did, which is a bookcase, which is a black and white bookcase, which he did in about 1958, and it was actually based partly on one of his father's designs, so it has a very interesting history because of that. I think the great thing is that there are a lot of names still to be discovered. You know, we're kind of through the French Prouvé sort of obsession. We're hopefully going to get through the sort of Finule Danish obsession. Dutch is well worth looking at, and I'm sure there's plenty of other areas of furniture in different parts of the world which are still waiting to be looked at in more detail.
Mid-Century Modern opened a new venue in Lord's Cricket Grounds in North London this year, and with prices ranging from £10 to £5,000, Monocle wondered if the clientele at the two different fairs varied.
At Lord's, we allow ourselves more expensive pieces. We are incredibly fussy at Lord's because it's a smaller show. Here we try and have a real mix of stuff for people. We understand, you know, we've got to be pretty inclusive to all kinds of people buying furniture. And we're really wanting to encourage people who don't know much about mid-century as well to come along and see pieces that maybe they've got in their mum and dad's places. And it to be not as pretentious as, you know, an Olympia-style show. It's really important for us for it to be a place that anybody can come to. The public doesn't feel intimidated by it. Having said that, we seem to get a ridiculous amount of incredible furniture designers like Matthew Hilton and Russell Pinch, and we get artists, Mike Nelson, Dinos Chapman's been before. So it's very exciting to get all these people who know a lot about design. Ola Keeley's one of our biggest fans. Sheridan Coakley popped in last year. I haven't seen him this time, but it's really exciting from having not tried too hard to get these people for free, that they actually just turn up because they've heard about it and they're excited about it, and it's something they can do on their Sunday.
The fair here in Dulwich, which we've done for a few years now, it's in some ways quite different from the Lord's event that started last year in May. Here in Dulwich, I joke that it's almost like an IKEA event on a Sunday. People come with their tape measures, they come looking for a chair, a table, a sofa. They're not particularly bothered about the designers, and they don't really ask about the designers' names. They just are interested in a good piece of design to put in their living room. At the Mid-Century Modern Fair at Lord's, it was a slightly different audience. That people knew more about the designers, asked about the designers' names and about their careers, and so it was surprisingly, a slightly more informed audience. So we do sell to what one might term as collectors. But equally, I'm just as interested in selling to members of the public who appreciate good design and want to actually use furniture.
Mid-century design is now roughly 60 years old, but still far from retiring. Lucy Ryder Richardson explains the longevity of mid-century pieces and reveals her favourites to Monocle.
Basically, I think it's something to do with the fact that my mum and dad, you know, their generation had this kind of furniture, and it makes us feel quite comfortable in a way. And especially in a recession, you go back to that, the kind of home comforts. And I mean, I say my mum and dad had it. Actually, my mum and dad only had a few bits in our playroom, but a lot of my friends, really cool mums and dads, had it. And I wanted them to be my mum and dad because I love their furniture. Sorry, mum and dad. So I think it's partly the comfort factor and also partly the eco factor. We're not throwing so much stuff in skips anymore. We really, really don't want to have to spend all our money at IKEA, and we don't necessarily have the money to go somewhere where we spend a lot of money on very expensive modern designers. You know, it loses value, you know, like a new car. Unless it's a really iconic piece, it could possibly lose value. So I think, you know, pretty well that none of this will go down in value unless your kids ruin it. So it's a pretty safe bet to buy mid-century furniture. I love people like Bruno Mathsson and Arne Jacobsen and George Nelson. But I think a lot of people who come to our shows, like the architects, buy really quirky pieces. They're looking for something a little bit different. Hans Wegner is one of my favourite people. I love Tapio Virkola's ceramics. He's a Finnish designer, amazing ceramics. It's just all a matter of taste.
That was Monocle's Thea Urdal at the Mid-Century Modern Furniture Sale in South London. You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24. Stay with us, we'll be back in a moment.
Every Monday, Monocle's culture editor, Robert Bound, casts a keen eye across the week's cultural events, taking in cinema, art, music, media, literature, and some of the world's more exclusive events. That's Culture with Robert Bound, premiering every Monday on Monocle 24 at 1900 London time and available on our Timeshift player and on iTunes.
Welcome back to Section D on Monocle 24 with me, Hugo MacDonald. It's a crime of architects and journalists alike that first world projects come first when it comes to grabbing the commissions and headlines. It's true that the discussion around third world countries and their urban development is gathering pace, but getting architects to study the environment and build in third world countries is another thing altogether. One man is doing a great deal to change this. David Adjaye is a renowned British architect, based in New York and born in Tanzania. He's recently completed a new book, Adjaye, Africa, Architecture, following a 10-year trip to 52 African cities. Our reporter, Daniel Giacopelli, sat down with Adjaye to hear about his experiences and tell us what he learned.
The new book is about African metropolitan architecture. Essentially, it's about a way of organising the continent, not by sort of a numerical sort of index, but by organising it into the geographic phenomena of the continent. So really, the book is about establishing a way of understanding the 54 countries that are in the continent now via regions, and thereby understanding something a bit more specific about their origins, their colonial relationship, their post-colonial relationship, their independence sort of scenarios, and their new modernities. It's organized into 7 volumes. 6 of them are the regions, and 1 is a book of essays from sort of intellectuals and philosophers who think about Africa, sort of ruminating about where we are now.
And this was a project a decade in the making.
Yes, it didn't start off as a decade project because I probably wouldn't have done it, but it started off as a quick study that would be done in a couple of years. And it's as I kind of explored the network of flights or the lack of flights to the continent directly, the issues about connectivity between places and my crazy schedule, it took 10 years, yeah.
What would you say is the biggest challenge facing urban areas generally on the continent as the growth of urban areas continues next century?
I think that what people don't understand is the incredible explosion that's occurring in terms of the migration from the countryside to the cities. These cities have been really 1 and 2 million size cities. You know, very few, except for Egypt, is like 17 million. Angola has maybe 7 million, etc. These are cities which are moving from 1 and 2 million to 5 and 6 and 7 within the space of a decade. And I think the greatest challenge is getting the infrastructure right for this explosion that's occurring, and then identifying what that modernity is going to look like, because what we all don't want are generic cities. What this book is trying to kind of put as a resistance out there is to say that we should try and not just make things that just make do because it's on the continent and we're grateful, but we should be very precise about why we're doing it, where we're doing it, and what it means.
When you were surveying all the cities in the past 10 years, what was the most striking or surprising thing that you saw?
I had so many surprises and striking things. You know, I'm a child of the continent. I probably knew about 7 countries very well. And I thought that meant I knew Africa better than anyone else. And then, you know, getting to go to 52 countries and realizing how little I knew as a person from the continent was astonishing. Just really learning about the incredible diversity of the continent was really a surprise, because in a way, I grew up in the forest region, what I'm calling the forest region. And so I knew Black Africa, much more specifically, but I really got to learn about the kind of mix of Southern Africa and the islands, and its Indonesian, Indian, sort of Arabic mix, and then North Africa with its incredible Berber, Arab, French mix, and then the Portuguese edges that are sort of also around, and the surprising Italian East African mix.
And which of the cities were the most innovative or promising in terms of architecture?
A GDP growth of the entire continent, if it was one place, would be around 15%, which is extraordinary. Places like Luanda are like 11, 12%. Places like Ghana are on record to make 15% growth this coming year. Deutsche Bank just released that, and people are like freaking out because it's extraordinary. It's a double-digit growth. These countries have the opportunities to make extraordinary architecture, the ones whose economies are suddenly exploding. I think that there's great precedent in places like Brazzaville, which has this extraordinary kind of architecture. I was sort of blown away by the legacy of modernity and sort of the kind of expertise of technology and moderating climate that was happening in that part of city making. I think that there's so much potential in Maputo, in Angola, in Dakar, in Cote d'Ivoire, actually in Khartoum, I think is fascinating.
And do you think young architects are playing a part in that? I mean, who are some young African architects that are?
There are several young African architects. The more famous ones are people like Francis Carrère from Ouagadougou, from Burkina Faso, Yuanda from Mbeki and his gang in South Africa, Joe Addo in Ghana. There's basically, it kind of breaks down, there's the North Africans, there's the East Africans and South Africans who kind of link together, and then there's the West Africans who kind of hang out as a gang. And they're starting to become present, and I'm really enjoying that.
You said before that the continent has strong public spaces.
Yes.
Can you explain what you mean by that?
There's a kind of an inhabitation which talks about the way in which you live in the outside world and the outside life, which is very prevalent because the interiority is not something that's important to most Africans, especially in the forest region. But the life of citizens is very much lived on the street and sort of exchanged in a way that's very, very rich.
Is that expressed by architects who might have left Africa, become educated in the West and returned in the architecture that they do back?
I think that some of the best examples I've seen really understand that the ground plane is a permeable plane. So, you know, in places, even from Algiers right through to Kigali, you know, there was a sense of trying to make an architecture which articulated the ground plane as much as possible so that there was permeability. Because really, I think in the context of the African city, with the exception of security, which sort of sets up a whole other set of issues, you know, the idea of the horizontality of the city across the ground plane is very important, even if it's a vertical city, this ability to dissolve it, because you don't have a climatic problem which makes insular outside, chamber inside, outside. You can actually dissolve that much more permeably. And I think that the kind of African way of life is about that horizontality that lives on the ground plane. That's very much the way the life is lived.
Do you think architects have a role to enact social change? In
I think if architects aren't part of social change, it's really sad. You know, I'm not trying to say that architecture itself is the agent of change, but architecture is the image of that agency that occurs. So I think that any great period which is framed by architecture sort of talks about the kind of revolution that happened and toppled one movement to the next. You know, modernity was about a triumph of technology and kind of rationale over a sort of Victorian idea of, you know, slumming and et cetera. So in a way, it was both an intellectual enlightenment, the notion of, you know, structuralism, and then it was a kind of manifestation within architecture. The two things lined. The elite bourgeois at the beginning no longer wanted neoclassical houses. They wanted houses built by Mies van der Rohe or Le Corbusier, which looked like aircraft or boats, because that was the new modernity. And I think that architecture is that powerful. It visualizes the change that happens. And I think when it's really good, it's directly in line.
What projects are you working on now?
We're working from, you know, the Smithsonian on the Washington Mall behind the White House, which is probably the most political project I've ever been engaged in.
Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, I mean, it's really to build the last Smithsonian on the Washington Mall. It's next to the National American Museum. So it will be the Museum of African American History and Culture. It is the last building before the Washington Memorial grounds. So it sort of is going to be opposite Lincoln and across from Jefferson and behind the White House. So strategically, it's a very, very important site. Capital is on the other side. The center of Washington was planned by Lord Font, an extraordinary French Creole character, as a mulatto, who's a mixed man, who planned Washington. He systematically laid out the buildings, and this is the last site that can be built. So it's a very profound thing to be doing.
And finally, if you had any piece of advice for a young African architect, what would you say?
I would say I'm so jealous. This is the best time to be an African architect. The whole world wants to know, and they don't know much. And if you know anything about your culture and your heritage, and if you don't, you should get on with it quickly because other people are going to know more than you. Go back and find out about the exciting things that are happening in your country.
That was Monocle's Daniel Giacopelli with architect David Adjei. You're listening to Section D here on Monocle 24. We'll be back in a moment. Welcome back to Section D with me, Hugo MacDonald. Sticking with the theme of architectural conundrums, we're off to Japan next. Following the great East Japan earthquake of March the 11th, the lives and homes of thousands were swept away. Emergency housing in disaster zones is something that many architects, and even Brad Pitt, have tackled with mixed results. Speed, cost, and ease of both mobility and construction are, of course, the primary concern. But little thought is given to the afterlife of emergency housing, and most often it ends up in a landfill once more permanent homes have been built. In the Tohoku region of Japan, a small but brilliant design firm, Oak Village, has devised a canny solution. Employing traditional techniques used in temple architecture and made entirely from local wood, Oak Village's emergency housing is a winner. Our Asia Bureau Chief, Kenji Hall, spoke to Dan Inamoto from Oak Village to find out more.
We are a woodworking company. We started off as a custom-made furniture maker, and we now build anything from small interior items to furniture to houses.
Now, in the aftermath of Japan's disaster in March, there was an immediate need to build as many temporary homes as quickly as possible. This is in the Tohoku region, which covers the country's northeastern shore. We saw major construction companies like Sekisui House, Misawa, Daiwa, building the standard prefab homes, essentially boxes of plastic and metal that aren't meant to last very long. The materials can be reused in some cases, but eventually they end up as landfill. So what we're going to talk about today is the temporary home that Oak Village has designed and has actually built.
So the shape of the house is a triangle when you look at it from the front. We took gassho zukuri, which is a traditional Japanese way of building a house in snowy regions, as the inspiration. So in Japanese, we call it gassho, which literally means putting two hands together. We used sugi, cedar, Japanese cedar, only for this structure, partially because there's an abundance of sugi in Japan. So we decided to, you know, take advantage of this resource and try to use as much as we can in a way that is sustainable, so that we don't necessarily, you know, use too many, but we use just enough to thin the forest and to get the material for the house.
So after the quake and tsunami, the government's number one priority seemed to be just to simply get people out of the emergency shelters, out of the school gyms and community centers where people were sleeping on hard wooden floors and where they had no privacy. And yet, you know, it seemed like the government was simply going after a target, a numerical target. I think the target was 30,000 temporary homes by the end of May, which would be just over 2 months after the disaster. And when the government fell short of that goal by 2,800 homes, they caught a lot of flack from the media and from, you know, ordinary voters. I wonder if you can talk a little bit about some of the problems with this kind of mentality, simply just putting something up to have it there quickly, and how your design for a temporary home hoped to solve these problems.
Right. So, I mean, I certainly understand that the government has to, you know, hit certain numbers and whatnot. But I think the number one consideration that we have is that those disaster victims that have to live in these temporary houses have to be, you know, have to be at home, have to be comfortable. Because one thing for sure is that these people have gone through an extremely, extremely difficult time. And so, you know, not only do they have to live in houses that are not theirs to begin with, but they also have to deal with the aftermath of this disaster, both, you know, physically and mentally. So we wanted to provide a space that you know, gives them some level of both physical and mental relief. Living in a wooden house definitely gives a sort of refreshing feeling, and, you know, I hope that some of the elderly people will feel at home, maybe even nostalgic of their houses in which they were brought up. Another, as you mentioned, is privacy. When you live in these prefab houses that are built of plastic and metal, obviously the walls are very thin, and so, you know, you can probably hear and even feel the vibration of you know, neighbors and whatnot. So we wanted to build something a little bit more stable and that provides a little bit of separation, a little bit of that creates some privacy to the residents.
That was Monocle's Kenji Hall in Tokyo. You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24. Stay tuned. You're back with Section D, Monocle's weekly design show, here on Monocle 24. Think of architecture in the Islamic world, and you probably think of glitzy building projects in the Middle East. People bemoan the soulless skyscrapers, the statement public architecture, dumped in cities with no regard for greater urban fabric. But there's much to be celebrated, too. Since 1977, the Aga Khan Award for Architecture has been given every 3 years to projects that set new standards of excellence in architecture, planning practices, historic preservation, and landscape architecture in the Islamic world. The award celebrates building concepts that address the needs of Muslim communities and Muslim culture. Former winners include a regenerated wetlands environment in Saudi Arabia, a textile factory in Turkey, and an urban revitalization plan in Tunisia. The 12th award is now open for nominations, so we dispatched Monocle reporter Lolita Laguna to track down the 2010 jury to hear about the award's impact.
My name is Farouk Darakshani, and I'm the director of the Aga Khan Award for Architecture, based in Geneva.
Why is the Aga Khan Award important?
The award is recognizing this process. That's what is unique. And it is not only for celebrating architecture with capital A, but it is the architecture which works. It's for the people. And architecture is not the results of the works of one talented architect sitting in the studio. It is collaboration between the clients, the architects, the builders. Each person has had contribution to the of something which is a good example of an architecture. Through the Aga Khan Award for Architecture, what we're trying to do is to see that end product from different points of view. And the most important is how it's used and what's the reaction of the users, how it has added value to its society and to its beneficiaries.
Well, I'm Alice Rosthorne, I'm the design critic of the International Herald Tribune, and I was on the master jury for the 2010 cycle of the awards. The Aga Khan initiated the awards originally many, many years ago because he was concerned about the then poor quality of architecture within the Islamic world, and he wanted to find a way of raising awareness of the importance of architecture and related disciplines like landscaping, structural engineering, infrastructural projects and so on, and also to find a way of sort of establishing thresholds for quality within the Islamic community.
My name is Mohsen Mostafavi, and I am the Dean of the Graduate School of Design at Harvard University, and I have been a member of the steering committee for the Aga Khan Awards for Architecture for the last three cycles. I think the value of the awards is that it recognizes good practice and significant projects in parts of the world where there's often very little attention given to the importance of good design. That concept has huge repercussions because on the one hand it could be seen to instigate other projects. It also helps as part of an educational process. It also helps us to discover and be much more sympathetic and appreciate, in a sense, the values of others and what people do in parts of the world where we are not necessarily so familiar with their achievements.
I'm Fashid Mousavi, and I am part of the steering committee of the Aga Khan Award. It is also, I think, very timely in terms of what it focuses on, the architecture that is built for the Muslim civilization. So it affects lots of lives, but it also is trying to focus on the fact that because this is spanning globally and in a way is intertwined with, at once with forces of globalization, but on the other hand with regional specific issues of how we tackle these two and how we make differences, but at the same time acknowledge our sameness with other places. I think this becomes a very interesting way to promote compassion pluralism, understanding amongst every one of us who are rubbing shoulders, but we may not have the same beliefs.
And what are we learning from the award and from the projects you're highlighting?
What you learn, it doesn't mean that you copy something, but it's the whole notion of that you say, oh, this is a challenge. This is how they've tackled this problem. And maybe I can tackle it in another way. So this is what is very important. The second thing is that then you can ask the people that, okay, what can I ask from the architect? I can ask them to do this better for me. And that's very important.
You know, the award can acknowledge a building no matter where it is built at. And it doesn't have to be really exclusively for Muslims. As long as it benefits people who are Muslim, most of the people who promote and who support the award in a more indirect sense. I've always kind of loved to see, say, a car park in Bradford one day becoming an award winner in that sense.
Because of the fact that this is an award that has been sustained over a long period of time, because it has also, over this duration, engaged a very large community of not only architects, but artists and philosophers and cultural historians. I am sure that it also has affected their practices and their work, which are often projects that go beyond so-called Muslim communities. Therefore, I think the concept of impact has multiple implications, and I'm sure that in many ways the impact has been very, very important, very significant in actually developing a culture of appreciation of good design.
From your point of view especially, what can listeners who aren't architects or within that industry take from the awards?
Well, for me as a non-architect, it was absolutely fascinating to be in the jury because it was an amazing learning experience. And half the jury were also non-architects. So there's Anish Kapoor, the artist, there was a philosopher, an art historian, and so on. So it's a very mixed jury. People have very different perspectives and areas of expertise. And of course, Islamic communities live in dramatically different situations. And so the kind of projects that we analysed were as much a sort of microcosm of contemporary architecture, contemporary urbanism, the global economy, the changes in contemporary culture, the drive towards sustainability. So we were looking at projects of dramatically different scales, completely different relationships to their local environments, to history, within local communities that again sort of ranged and diverged dramatically in both scale and the dynamics of those communities. So it was a really fascinating exercise. You know, we looked at a massive multi-occupancy apartment building in one of China's biggest cities, sort of all the way through one of the nominated projects was a teeny tiny observation deck in a very far-flung stretch of the Bangladeshi jungle. So it was quite an extraordinary experience.
To see past recipients of the award, you can go online to www.akdn.org/architecture. And the next cycle of the awards is now open and taking nominations.
That was Monocle reporter Lolita Laguna telling us all about the Aga Khan Award for Architecture. Get nominating. You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24. It's time now for Monocle's resident photography director and poet, Poppy Shibamoto, to paint a picture in words of something that's caught her eye in the current edition of Monocle. Take it away, Poppy.
It was a bright and sunny summer morning at 8:45 when an unfortunate and scared pigeon flew into my kitchen window all of a sudden. With a loud crash and with much broken glass, it landed and died on our floor. Boom. I've had a bird phobia since this avian attack. Not just a phobia of birds flying through windows onto our lovely shiny kitchen floor, but also pronouncing the word bird. I have to concentrate really hard to get the sound out of my Japanese mouth. We have three birds pictures in the December and January issue of Monocle magazine. It was unavoidable given the sheer volume of this issue. One wooden retro duck by Hans Bolling. One black Eames housebird, and the third one is L'Oiseau by Brulec Brothers, designed for Vitra. This French l'oiseau is made of a beautiful cream-coloured maple wood, shaped and sanded to a smooth finish, with no varnish or polish. It's minimally sculptural and simply shaped, just enough to communicate the idea that this is a bird, and draws my imagination into thinking which type of bird this actually is. It's curvy-looking from the front with a plump chest, with the fine lines gathered towards its little pointy closed beak. From the side, the body is simplified and is streamlined like a golf putter. I can imagine that this bird could probably swim in the water too. The shadow that is cast by the bird's elegant beak makes it look lean in profile, and its tail lifts upwards charmingly. The body shows different cuts of maple wood grain too. He looks very classy, yet familiar, and feels like an artifact that could be found in a village within a rich folk art history. This sophisticated wingless French bird might be able to make me forget about the terrible invasion that occurred one fateful summer morning. Our design editor Hugo tells me that having a bird object in the house will protect me from unwelcome intruders. So maybe I should get a wooden bird to scare off its real-life feathered friends. That way I won't have to suffer nightmares directed by Alfred Hitchcock anymore.
That was Monocle's photo director, Poppy Shibamoto, soon to invest in a wooden house bird to keep the real ones away. You're listening to Section D here on Monocle 24. We'll be back in a moment.
For listeners in Tokyo or visitors to Japan, you can now enjoy a coffee, a Wilkinson dry ginger ale, or our classic curry at our first ever Monocle cafe and shop at the new Hankyu Men's Department Store, just steps from Ginza and the lobby of the peninsula. Featuring a Monocle shop stocked with our ever-expanding collection of special collaborations, the Monocle Cafe is the perfect place to refuel after a run round the Imperial Palace or a busy day in Marunouchi. For more details, visit monocle.com.
Welcome one and all, welcome back to Section D on Monocle 24 with me, Hugo MacDonald. It's time to head to Austria, to hear how the design community in the Austrian capital is shaping up. Vienna is a city with no shortage of craft and design history, and it's this that Vienna Design Week is seeking to capitalise on. The young event is being nurtured to educate about the past and inspire a future generation to continue the legacy, as Tulga Bayerl, founder of Vienna Design Week, reveals.
We'll never forget when we started 2007, we sat together one day and we had like not 1 cent yet. We always were hopelessly optimistic. We cannot be demotivated in the crazy things we are trying to achieve. But it was really an amazing moment because we had not very much money and we just started very small, few foreign designers, a lot of Austrian designers as well, but very good designers in any case. From the start, we wanted to work with the museums as well. We said Vienna is a city of culture. Vienna is not known as a design city. It's known as a cultural destination. That's what people expect when they come to the city. And we always wanted to work with the tradition of the city as well, because that's another thing you can really work with. You don't need to pretend that this is the most modern place on earth. We have a lot of projects of our own, and I think that's also something that makes it specific, because we do not only offer the facility or the possibility to show something, we do a lot of process-oriented projects, and that's what we're strong at. And that's something we grew quite fast over only 5 years. The Passionswege is a project we started from the early beginning, where we thought it would be interesting to look at producing companies in the city of Vienna. It could be like a very elaborate, luxurious glass manufacturer like Lohmeyer, but it could also be a very simple craftsperson that is a tapissier, or maybe it's even just a watch repairer or something like that. But these are qualities in cities that very often are overlooked. So we bring together young designers with these companies. Sometimes they're also simple shops, but usually they produce something or they have a craft. And we ask both of them to get to know each other, to kind of exchange, share their knowledge and their expertise. And then the designers are invited to come up with a project that is like a comment on what this person or this organization is good at. It's not necessarily a product, can be an installation as well. We leave it totally open. Both partners are invited by us, so they kind of meet on a very specific level, because the designers are not commissioned by the company, they're commissioned by us. We also pay the designers, not the organization, not the producing company pays the designer, we do. So they're quite free and reacting to that producing company and show an interesting work at the end, which takes, they start working in June maybe, and then we have the presentation in October. From the very beginning, we never wanted to do a local event in the sense of we show our local creative potential. I think because we are very aware that this is a rather small city and we wouldn't have enough potential to only feed the festival out of that. Plus, we always wanted to offer our local expertise, or as the expert audience, an interesting debate and dialogue with international designers. But we certainly always wanted to make a wide festival, an open festival for everyone. So we wanted to reach an audience that is not only the design expert, the design nerd, the collector, or something like that, but also the most average people, because design, in our opinion, has this wide kind of description of what it is about. It's not only about luxury and beautiful things, but it could also be about social themes, it could be about services, it could be about public space. There are a lot of other aspects we want to look at in the festival, and we are able now in the meantime to really reach a wider audience. We can see that. We see a lot of people that obviously have nothing to do with design, and they come to the Design Week and enjoy it very much. In general, we always try, because Vienna is a beautiful city and it's very traditional and very elegant and very classy, classic, and classicism is all over this place. But it's also good to kind of either bring people to places that are not so elegant at all. So we every year we have a special district where we look at and we try and guide people in strange neighborhoods. And then they actually, the international audience is really happy about that, because many of them know Vienna and they know the Ringstrasse and the Burgtheater and the Opera House and so on, and the MAC and all these things. They might not know rather off locations, which have their own qualities, and they enjoy being there. On the other hand, we also want to bring our own local audience to kind of rediscover the city. So it is very connected with the city itself. That's the reason why we always decided not to have one location and put everything there. It makes it extremely difficult, but it's really interwoven into the fabric of the city.
That was Monocle correspondent Kimberly Bradley in Vienna. You're listening to Section D here on Monocle 24, and we're almost out of time this week. Not before a quick spin around three design shops, though, to hear what's been ringing their tills in the run-up to Christmas. We jetted north first, to Helsinki 10, where Yasvin, behind the counter, kicked off our trolley dash.
Now we have the latest Kastavajak collection, which is a continuation of previous collections, which were all Disney-themed. And we also have a Belgian designer, Anne de Milmeester, and Rico Owens, an American designer. And we also have Damir Doma, amongst others. And he's a Croatian designer, but he's Paris-based. And we also have a lot of Finnish, contemporary Finnish designers like Laitinen and Daniel Palilo. One of the most popular items in our store at the moment is a cocktail dress by Kastavajak, and it's taken inspiration from a Disney cartoon, 101 Dalmatians, and it's very light and it's very fun and it's very bright colored and very humorous. And I think one of the reasons why it's so popular is because, you know, we're approaching wintertime and it's very dark in Finland and very gloomy. And I think people want to take their minds off of that.
Hi, I'm James Brown, the owner of Hostem on Redchurch Street in East London.
I think we've really noticed that footwear for us has really, you know, been a massive success this season. I think people want something that's going to last. I think something that's got longevity. I think this kind of like frivolous attitude towards, you know, pieces that are worth X amount at the beginning of the season, all of a sudden they're in sale and a new trend's moved on and they're no longer kind of relevant. So I think we've noticed a lot of our, you know, good customers are buying into footwear, you know, handmade shoes that are going to last them 3 or 4 years. So they really get value for their money, even though they're expensive to start with. At the moment, we have a window that has been designed for the Elder Statesman, which is a cashmere brand that we have exclusivity of here in the UK, based in Los Angeles by Greg Chait. Everything's sort of handmade, hand-loomed. In LA, he uses Laura Piana cashmere, and we've decided to celebrate the branding story. It's definitely a key brand for us. His actual brand logo is a tree, and so we found a dead pear tree and we sort of brought it in, and then Jade's reworked these handmade owls made out of the cashmere and the yarn, and we've got all different cashmere pieces hanging from the tree in the window. Our best-selling piece would have to be a handmade shoe by a 1923. It's an artisan shoemaker that's based in Rome. He makes every single shoe by hand. The soles are, you know, handmade, the nails are tacked into the soles, the leather's hand-dyed, he even kills the animals himself. We get a delivery sort of once every year or so in very limited quantity. And yeah, they sell incredibly well. It's got a very loyal following, and it's, you know, when you pick them up, you can really feel the handmade nature of them, the love that's gone into them.
My name is Stephen Taffel, and I am the owner of LeFaux Men's Shoe Store in the West Village of Manhattan. LeFaux is a select men's shop. We focus on footwear for men, shoes that are made in England, United States, France, and in addition to the shoes that we sell, we have a select items that relate in terms of leather, wallets and belts and soft goods such as socks and hats. At the moment, boots have been selling very well, especially American-made boots, particularly by brands like Wolverine and Alden, sort of heritage brands that have been around for 100 years or more. It's quite popular to have men of all ages, but particularly a lot of younger guys in their, let's say, 20s to 30s who are focusing on that type of footwear. I think that when men are out in the market and looking for products for themselves, particularly shoes, they're looking for quality. And I think that there's a nostalgic feeling among people that they just don't make things like they used to, and, you know, tend to look back and, you know, oh, this is something my father wore. And, you know, I think that's what's driving a lot of it today. For me, I mean, it's a lot of fun. I mean, we have a wide range of customers, young guys starting out to collect and assemble a great shoe collection. We have men who are older and more mature that have been wearing quality shoes for a long time. Guys who have a lot of knowledge about footwear, and young guys who are just sort of willing to learn. So it's a lot of give and take, back and forth, and it's a little bit of educating, and it's a little bit of hand-holding sometimes. But for us, it's very gratifying when customers find a pair of shoes or a particular item that they really enjoy using.
And that, I'm afraid, really is all we've got time for this week on Section D. But fear not, next week's show, we're heading to Miami for a design art special. More than just million-pound sofas, we'll be hearing how Design Miami is having a positive long-term impact on the local community. All that, and much, much more to look forward to then. This week's show was produced by Dawn Trump and researched by Thea Urdal and Hazel Pfeiffer. Tune in next week at 1900 hours London time on Tuesday the 6th of December. Bye-bye for now.